I want to turn now to a specific talk on the civil rights movement itself. Remember at the time of Reconstruction that we had talked about needing a second Reconstruction because the goals of the first Reconstruction, which ended in 1877, even though slavery had been abolished, equal citizenship before the law had been established, and black men on paper had the right to vote, there were certain constitutional things that were ignored. And African-American rights were somewhat ignored majorly after 1877. And segregation and white supremacy reestablished itself, predominantly in the American South, but not limited to. So by 1947, Harry Truman had desegregated the armed forces and federal jobs, and civil rights is going to be back on the table politically. This is not to say that it hadn't been there during World War II. You'd had the Double V campaign, you know, victory over Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo and totalitarianism and all its mess, but also victory over the lack of American freedoms. So, you know, this was something to think about. And by the 1950s, you have a filibuster against a civil rights bill. You have the murder of Emmett Till in 1955, which is considered the event that begins the modern civil rights movement. Just shortly after the trial of the murderers of Emmett Till, you have Rosa Parks refusing to give up her seat on a bus. She is kicked off the same bus by the same bus driver for the second time. But now in the 1950s, you have media. So more people are hearing about things like this. You know, in the 1950s, people could say, well, there's no such thing as a lynching of American people. There's no such thing as a black boy traveling from Chicago down to Mississippi could be murdered for whistling at a white woman. These things don't happen here in the country, that, you know, people are being assaulted, particularly because of their race. Media is going to change that. And so when people turn on their televisions by 1957 and they see what's happening in Little Rock, Arkansas, or in 1963 with Birmingham, Alabama, you know, they could not deny, because they saw the images on television, that these things were happening in America. In 1896, if you remember, the Supreme Court had established the separate but equal policy in Plessy versus Ferguson. And, of course, this made things separate but equal. And also, there were all kind of laws on the books maintaining legal segregation. There were laws on the books in a lot of states barring interracial marriage. There were laws maintaining separate water fountains, separate swimming pools, separate hotels. And so segregation was, frankly, a way of in the majority of lives in America during this particular time. And also there were de facto laws, you know, laws by custom, Jim Crow laws, how a black man needed to get off the sidewalk if a white woman was coming towards her. And by the 1950s, there was the ingrained idea of racial separation, that races did not need to mingle. And also predominantly that black men did not need to be around white women. And, of course, you know, these are themes picked up in 1960 with the publication of Harper Lee's novel, To Kill a Mockingbird. And this was American life, you know, from the 1890s into the 1940s and 50s. World War II, again, exposed the racism in America. It exposed the lack of equity. If you remember, maybe perhaps from our talk in class, A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, a black labor union, had threatened to have a march on Washington because of inequality of wages in 1940 and 41. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt will sign an executive order promising equity in federal jobs. But that idea for a march on Washington doesn't go away. And eventually, who's going to be marching in the front line on August 28, 1963? And that's A. Philip Randolph in Bayard Rustin's organized March on Washington festivities. Well, in 1947, on the heels of the Necessary War, Jackie Robinson is integrated into baseball by the Brooklyn Dodgers. Already the American Football League had integrated its league with some very famous African Americans. Jackie Robinson paved the way for other very famous African Americans to get involved in baseball. In 1954, you have the very famous Brown decision that not only said that schools needed to be desegregated, but also ordered that they be desegregated with all deliberate speed. Very, very, very influential decision that kind of overturned this idea of separate but equal. This doesn't mean that things changed overnight. It's going to take a lot of years, particularly in the American South, to make this happen. And some scholars today suggest that schools are more segregated than ever, not necessarily by race, but especially by class. Well, let's think about a young man by the name of Michael King. Michael King, like his father, will have his name changed to Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King wins a high school contest on the Constitution. And while he's riding to Washington, D.C. to deliver his speech that he writes about the Constitution, he has to sit in the back of the bus. So here's this young man who's profoundly affected by this moment of winning a competition, essay competition about the Constitution, but yet he's experiencing segregation and white supremacy on the bus ride to Washington, D.C. He attends his daddy's church, Ebenezer Church in Atlanta. He will also end up pastoring with him for a time. But he goes to Montgomery, Alabama in 1955 to pastor a church, the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. It's there he's trying to work on his dissertation from Boston University. And he is swept up in Rosa Parks' event of refusing to give up her seat on the bus. You know, Rosa Parks is sitting in the right spot. She's sitting in the black section of the bus. But the rule was, if more whites got on, African Americans had to give up their seats. And, of course, you know, she refuses, and so she's arrested. The NAACP needed a woman of character to try to have a test case to end segregation on city buses. Other women had been thrown off the buses. But Rosa Parks is a fine woman of character, and she's just the kind of person that the NAACP needs to challenge in court racial segregation on a city bus. Later on, after the Montgomery bus boycott, which lasts minimally 11 months, the U.S. Supreme Court will rule that segregation on city buses is unconstitutional. Dr. King, during this time, or Martin Luther King, during this time, becomes the leader of the Montgomery Improvement Association. He's in his 20s, in his early 20s, and in reality his first thought is that he doesn't want to get involved. But as Rosa Parks refuses to give up her seat, as the Montgomery bus boycott begins, one night he is said to have heard the audible voice of God saying, "Martin, stand up for justice." And so he'll get involved with his method of nonviolence. The boycott is about nonviolence. It's about making an economic statement. And later on, he will write a book about the boycott called Stride Toward Freedom. And as he is having a book signing in Harlem, he will be stabbed by a woman with a letter opener. And as that wound heals, it will create the message, it'll create the symbol of a cross just over his heart. And so for the rest of his life, which will not be terribly long, he will talk about taking up the cross. And of course the cross is of civil rights and social justice. Martin Luther King was a big believer in nonviolence. He had read Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience. He had been heavily influenced by Mr. Gandhi in India. And so from Montgomery, they'll move on to Albany, Georgia. And in Albany, Georgia, they don't have a lot of success. But Dr. King will become a leader of preachers in a civil rights organization called SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. At times, he and his organization will work very well with students in an organization called SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It'll be SNCC in the 1960s that will begin to do sit-ins across the South at lunch counters to argue for equity and freedom at lunch counters. 2 years after the Little Rock Nine, 2 years after the Montgomery bus boycott, you'll have the Little Rock Nine incident in at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. In 1957, nine black students will compete to integrate the best high school in Arkansas, Central High School, still a working high school today. Unfortunately, they are met by parents and students who create a riot on the first day. And, you know, President Eisenhower will be in contact with the Arkansas governor, Orville Faubus, and Orville Faubus says he's got this under control. But he doesn't. And ultimately, President Eisenhower will send in troops from the 101st Airborne Division to protect the nine students. One student will be expelled through the course of the year, but eight students will end up integrating the best high school in Arkansas in 1957. And I'll be telling you some stories about this in class. The most important thing to think about in regards to this is that Eisenhower will be willing to send federal troops in to enforce the Constitution of the United States. You know, there were groups called the Freedom Riders, like I mentioned in my Kennedy lecture, that will be riding through the American South to desegregate city buses. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee will be staging sit-ins in places like Nashville, where the first march of the movement will take place to integrate lunch counters. On February 1st, 1960, you'll have the first sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina, where four North Carolina A&T students will stage a sit-in at the Woolworths. And within days, there'll be more than 500 sit-ins across the American South, kind of in the model of Greensboro. So 1960, you have the sit-in movement beginning. 1960-61, you have the Freedom Riders. Eventually, the Freedom Riders will obtain federal protection to ride through the South. By 1961-62, James Meredith will be integrated into the University of Mississippi. And so it's John Kennedy that thinks about getting a new civil rights bill together. It had been the same year of the Little Rock crisis that you had one of the first big congressional filibusters over a proposed civil rights bill. And now by the early 60s, people are hopeful that things can be better, as the Kennedy administration urged, you know, for things to be better. However, by 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, one of the most segregated cities in America, there'll be events in Birmingham, Alabama, that will challenge this idea that things are getting better. In the spring of 1963, Martin Luther King will come to Birmingham to lead a movement to integrate downtown stores, to integrate lunch counters, to integrate the city parks, the city swimming pools. And he'll be arrested on Good Friday, 1963. He'll be in solitary confinement in Birmingham. He's not allowed to have paper and pencil. While he is in jail, there's an op-ed piece in the New York Times constructed by eight white clergymen. And they're calling Dr. King a troublemaker. They're calling his actions untimely and unwise because he's coming there to encourage acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King takes the newspaper that his lawyer gives him, and he writes a response to the eight white ministers, and this becomes the letter from a Birmingham jail. Later on, it will be published as a treatise on civil rights during this particular time. And basically, it's an answer about why nonviolence, why standing up to an unjust law, is the right thing to do. You know, just a couple months after Dr. King is arrested, you'll have the March on Washington, and that's something that we'll get back to in a minute. Around the time that Dr. King is arrested in Birmingham, there'll be something occurring called the Children's March. And in Birmingham in the spring and late spring, summer of 1963, children will meet at local churches like the 16th Street Baptist Church, and they will march through Kelly Ingram Park, a local park, into downtown to bring up the problem of segregation. It's at this time and during events like this that Bull Connor, the chief of public safety, will bring out the local police dogs and the local fire department to spray water at great force onto the marchers. Again, there were people in America that were saying, hey, this couldn't happen. You know, these are just stories from a long time ago. But when they saw this footage on the national news at night, remember there were only three channels that you could get, ABC, NBC, CBS. There's no 24-hour news channels like there are today. And there would be enough footage of Birmingham to fill up the nightly news. And so people began to be convinced that, hey, when they saw an unmuzzled German Shepherd dog go after a young person, or when they see a young girl picked up by the force of a water hose and spun in the street, you know, these kind of things become embarrassing to the American government in a time of the Cold War. So by early summer 1963, John Kennedy is moved to give a speech on race. And that may be one of the speeches that you get a chance to look at in class. In August of 1963, you have the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. This was a very good day, August 28th, 1963, because the Kennedy administration has moved to kind of put the full throttle, the pedal to the metal, on passing a civil rights bill. There were 10 speeches that day, and of course, very few people remember the first nine, but they do remember the 10th, because Dr. King will use the image of the dream that he had used in past speeches to give the I Have a Dream portion of the speech. It was not the speech that he was going to give that day, but he was encouraged as he was at the podium to give him the dream. And so his words, you know, he will give from memory, the I Have a Dream portion of the speech. And it's a great day. Later on in the day, Dr. King will meet John Kennedy at the White House, and John Kennedy extends his hand and says, hey, I too have a dream. And these are two of the world's leaders coming together during this time. Tragically, it's not going to be too long before John Kennedy is assassinated. But Lyndon Johnson will also purposefully work with Dr. King. Dr. King and Lyndon Johnson will purposely work together to get a civil rights bill passed, partly in John Kennedy's honor. You know, there were other civil rights organizations that were working for the same goal of achieving civil rights, but they were not always content or happy with Dr. King in that role as national leader. You had Malcolm X, who was one of the leaders for the Nation of Islam. You had James Farmer, who was working with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. You had, eventually, in the later 60s, you had the Black Panthers with a whole different aspect of what civil rights is going to look like. You had many different civil rights organizations. You had several different kinds of leaders. They're working for the same goal, but they're just very different. To give you a very brief example, Malcolm X, Nation of Islam, it's more of an urban movement. Malcolm X will be a little bit more militant than Dr. King. Malcolm X will say, hey, if somebody strikes me, I'm not going to practice nonviolence. I will strike them back. I won't be like Jesus. I will strike them back. And even though publicly he is not terribly supportive of the March on Washington, privately he's very supportive of the march and its goals. You know, Dr. King's movement, a little more southern, a little more rural, not advocating violence, but in a lot of ways advocating the vote. Malcolm X will say, hey, we don't want ballots, we want bullets. We'll choose bullets over the ballots. Dr. King was a lot more advocating the vote. Okay? Well, the Civil Rights Act is signed in August of 1964, and this is on the heels of something called Freedom Summer. And Freedom Summer was about voting in Mississippi. And basically what people did, organizers in Mississippi, in the summer of 1964 is they had a mock election. And they sent delegates to the Democratic National Convention that year in Atlantic City. They a lot of people, white and black, particularly white students who went through a workshop in Ohio and then were bused down or carred down to Mississippi, they went door to door asking people if they wanted to register to vote, showing people how to register to vote, because, you know, one of the big aspects of 1964 and 65 following the Civil Rights Act is people realized that, there was a need for voting. After the March on Washington in 1963 in August, there was the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in September of 63, and following the death of four little girls inside the church and up to nine students and children being wounded that day in various capacities. There were a lot of civil rights workers that decided, hey, it's time to get the vote, that the only way these things are going to change, the only way racism is going to end, the only way segregation is going to end is by getting the vote and voting people out of office. So it was real purposeful that there was a Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964. It is during Freedom Summer that three civil rights workers, two white and one black, Goodman, Schwerner, the two white men, and James Chaney, the black man, disappear. And so the big question in the summer of 1964 in America is, where are Goodman, Chaney, and Schwerner? And of course their bodies will be found, and it just angers people, and it spurs the Johnson administration to continue to try to do more for civil rights. One of the things that occurred in March of 1965 was the murder of Jimmie Lee Jackson. Jimmie Lee Jackson was an American veteran, and during a local meeting at a church in a nearby town, Jimmie Lee Jackson is shot and killed by a state trooper. And it was decided among workers of SNCC and SCLC members that it would be appropriate to march from Selma to Montgomery, 54 miles, in a symbolic march for voting rights. On March 6, 1965, you have an event called Bloody Sunday, where some of these marchers were met just after crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge by local officials, by state troopers, by deputized cattlemen with their electric cattle prods. And the event will be called Bloody Sunday, where civil rights marchers are injured on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Edmund Pettus had been a Civil War veteran from Alabama. And today, the Edmund Pettus Bridge is called the Bridge to Freedom. These young students, young kids, and local teachers from Selma and other people were very excited that Dr. King had come to town for a second march, because the first march had ended in Bloody Sunday and people were turned around. But the civil rights workers had not gotten the okay to march. And so while civil rights attorneys were in court and trying to work for the march, Dr. King comes to town. He leads civil rights peoples across the bridge again. But he gets to the bottom of the bridge where the events of Bloody Sunday had occurred, and he knows that he's going to break the law if he starts marching to Montgomery. And he decides not to, and he kneels and has somebody pray, and then the march becomes the turnaround march, because he turns everybody around and they walk back across the bridge. For the third time, Dr. King will lead a third march after the federal government makes the decision that the march is legal. And so in mid-March 1965, civil rights peoples will march from Selma to Montgomery. It takes 5 days, but it becomes the impetus for Lyndon Johnson and Congress passing the voting rights bill and Lyndon Johnson signing it. And also I would say to you that that the same month of the three marches in Selma, and with the last one being from Selma to Montgomery, you have U.S. Marines officially landing in Vietnam. So here's a moment in August of 1965, when you have the civil rights movement crossing the Vietnam War. You know, one of the leaders of SNCC, who later branches off, is a gentleman by the name of Stokely Carmichael. The civil rights movement will fracture by 1964-65, and some African Americans, upset with the slow pace of nonviolence, will begin to argue for black power. Malcolm X will leave the Nation of Islam, and he will support Dr. King in Selma, and he will also be killed in 1965. What does this lead to by 1966-67? Something called the Long Hot Summers in Chicago and Newark, New Jersey, and different places where minorities begin to riot against police and certain peoples. A lot of these Long Hot Summers will culminate in 1968 as Dr. King, as Robert Kennedy, are also assassinated. In 1966, Bobby Seale and Huey Newton will form the Black Panthers, and the Black Panthers coming out of Oakland, California, will accept violence as a means of attaining equal rights. And we have to remember that by 1965-66, the Vietnam War will be in full swing, and a lot of these civil rights ideas and civil rights organizations will transfer themselves to Vietnam because of things like a draft and so forth. What's the legacy of civil rights? The legacy of civil rights is that in the 1960s there'll be three civil rights acts: the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, ending discrimination in public places; the Voting Rights Act of 1965; and the Equal Housing Act of 1968. The civil rights movement will fracture. In 1967, Martin Luther King will speak out against the Vietnam War, and this will end his partnership with Lyndon Johnson. Also by 1968, Lyndon Johnson, the president who had done more for civil rights in such a short amount of time, will refuse to run again as the Vietnam War is heating up. And the Tet Offensive, he's really been affected by something called the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, so he will refuse to run again. And so civil rights will fracture as a result of the Vietnam War, as a result of Dr. King and Lyndon Johnson refusing to communicate further, and also because Lyndon Johnson refuses to run again. There will be other civil rights things occurring because the anti-war movement, the feminist movement, the gay movement, the other kinds of movements that occur in the 60s and 70s will learn from the civil rights movement how to accomplish objectives. Civil disobedience, protests, mass media. These are things that will be further ingrained into American society over time. But we'll see that the Catholic monk and writer Thomas Merton called 1968 a beast of a year because of the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King and the Tet Offensive and all these kind of things that are hitting to a head, civil unrest and cities at home like Washington, D.C. On the night of Dr. King's assassination, 120 American cities will burn, April 4th, 1968. And in a lot of ways, this is going to be a very bloody year in Vietnam, 1968, and a very tough year at home. So Vietnam will fracture the civil rights movement, but also the tensions at home over war and peace will also fracture those kinds of things. Thank you.